Chapter 5. They went home together, Tess holding one arm of her father, and Mrs. Durbyfield the other. He had, in truth, drunk very little, not a fourth of the quantity which a systematic tippler could carry to church on a Sunday afternoon without a hitch in his eastings of genuflections. But the weakness of Sir John's constitution made mountains of his petty sins in this kind. On reaching the fresh air he was sufficiently unsteady to incline the row of three at one moment, as if they were marching to London, and at another, as if they were marching to Bath, which produced a comical effect, frequent enough in families on nocturnal amigoings, and, like most comical effects, not quite so comic after all. The two women valiantly disguised these forced excursions and countermarches as well as they could from Durbyfield their cause, and from Abraham, and from themselves. And so they approached by degrees their own door, the head of the family bursting suddenly into his former refrain as he drew near, as if to fortify his soul at sight of the smallness of his present residence, "I've got a family vault at Kingsmere." "Hush, don't be so silly, Jackie," said his wife. "Yours is not the only family that was of count in old days. Look at the Yanktels, and Horses, and the Tringhams themselves gone to see Amist as much as you, though you was bigger folks than they, that's true. Thank God, I was never of no family, and have nothing to be ashamed of in that way. Don't you be so sure o' that. From you neither, 'tis my belief you've disgraced yourselves more than any o' us, and was kings and queens outright at one time." Tess turned the subject, by saying what was far more prominent in her own mind at the moment than thoughts of her ancestry, "I'm afraid father won't be able to take the journey with the beehives tomorrow so early." I shall be all right in an hour or two," said Durbyfield. It was 11 o'clock before the family were all in bed, and 2 o'clock next morning was the latest hour for starting with the beehives, if they were to be delivered to the retailers in Casterbridge before the Saturday market began, the way thither lying by bad roads over a distance of between 20 and 30 miles, and the horse and wagon being of the slowest. At 1:30 Mrs. Durbyfield came into the large bedroom, where Tess and all her little brothers and sisters slept. "The poor man can't go," she said to her eldest daughter, whose great eyes had opened the moment her mother's hand touched the door. Tess sat up in bed, lost in a vague interspace between a dream and this information. "But somebody must go," she replied. "Tea is late for the hives already. Swarming will soon be over for the year. And if we put off taking 'em till next week's market, the call for 'em will be passed, and they'll be thrown on our hands." Mrs. Durbyfield looked unequal to the emergency. "Ome young feller, perhaps, would go? One of them who were so much, after dancing with thee yesterday," she presently suggested. "Oh no, I wouldn't have it for the world," declared Tess proudly. "And letting everybody know the reason such a thing to be ashamed of. I think I could go, if Abraham could go with me to keep me company." Her mother at length agreed to this arrangement. Little Abraham was aroused from his deep sleep in a corner of the same apartment, and made to put on his clothes, while still mentally in the other world. Meanwhile Tess had hastily dressed herself, and the twain, lighting a lantern, went out to the stable. The rickety little wagon was already laden, and the girl led out the horse Prince, only a degree less rickety than the vehicle. The poor creature looked wonderingly round at the night, at the lantern, at their two figures, as if he could not believe that at that hour, when every living thing was intended to be in shelter and at rest, he was called upon to go out and labor. They put a stock of candle ends into the lantern, hung the ladder to the off side of the load, and directed the horse onward, walking at his shoulder at first during the uphill parts of the way, in order not to overload an animal of so little vigor. To cheer themselves as well as they could, they made an artificial morning with the lantern, some bread and butter, and their own conversation, the real morning being far from come. Abraham, as he more fully awoke, for he had moved in a sort of trance so far, began to talk of the strange shapes assumed by the various dark objects against the sky, of this tree that looked like a raging tiger springing from a lair of that which resembled a giant's head. When they had passed the little town of Storecastle, dumbly somnolent under its thick brown thatch, they reached higher ground. Still higher, on their left, the elevation called Bulbarrow or Bulbarrow, well nigh the highest in South Wessex, swelled into the sky, and girdled by its earthen trenches. From here about the long road was fairly level for some distance onward. They mounted in front of the wagon, and Abraham grew reflective. "Tess," he said in a preparatory tone, after a silence. "Yes, Abraham. Bain't you glad that we've become gentle folk?" "Not particular glad. But you be glad that you am going to marry a gentleman?" "What?" said Tess, lifting her face. "That our great relation will help me to marry a gentleman." "Aye? Our great relation? We have no such relation. What has put that into your head?" "I heard them talking about it up at Rolliver's when I went to find father. There's a rich lady of our family out at Trantridge, and mother said that, if you claimed kin with the lady, she'd put you in the way of marrying a gentleman." His sister became abruptly still, and lapsed into a pondering silence. Abraham talked on, rather for the pleasure of utterance than for audition, so that his sister's abstraction was of no account. He leant back against the hives, and with upturned face made observations on the stars, whose cold pulses were beating amid the black hollows above, in serene dissociation from these two wisps of human life. He asked how far away those twinklers were, and whether God was on the other side of them. But ever and anon his childish prattle recurred to what impressed his imagination even more deeply than the wonders of creation. If Tess were made rich by marrying a gentleman, would she have money enough to buy a spyglass so large that it would draw the stars as near to her as Netlicum Tout? The renewed subject, which seemed to have impregnated the whole family, filled Tess with impatience. "Never mind that now," she exclaimed. "Did you say the stars were worlds, Tess?"
"Yes."
"All like ours?"
"I don't know, but I think so. They sometimes seem to be like the apples on our stubborn tree. Most of them splendid, and sound a few blighted."
"Which do we live on, a splendid one or a blighted one?"
"A blighted one."
"'Tis very unlucky that we didn't pitch on a sound one when there were so many more of 'em."
"Yes.
Is it like that really, Tess?" said Abraham, turning to her much impressed, on reconsideration of this rare information. "How would it have been if we had pitched on a sound one?
Well, father wouldn't have coughed and creeped about as he does, and wouldn't have got too tipsy to go on this journey, and mother wouldn't have been always washing, and never getting finished.
And you would have been a rich lady ready-made, and not have had to be made rich by marrying a gentleman?"
"Oh, Abe, don't talk of that anymore."
Left to his reflections, Abraham soon grew drowsy. Tess was not skillful in the management of a horse, but she thought that she could take upon herself the entire conduct of the load for the present, and allow Abraham to go to sleep, if he wished to do so. She made him a sort of nest in front of the hives, in such a manner that he could not fall, and, taking the reins into her own hands, jogged on as before. Prince required but slight attention, lacking energy for superfluous movements of any sort. With no longer a companion to distract her, Tess fell more deeply into reverie than ever, her back leaning against the hives. The mute procession past her shoulders of trees and hedges became attached to fantastic scenes outside reality, and the occasional heave of the wind became the sigh of some immense sad soul, conterminous with the universe in space, and with history in time. Then, examining the mesh of events in her own life, she seemed to see the vanity of her father's pride, the gentlemanly suitor awaiting herself in her mother's fancy, to see him as a grimacing personage, laughing at her poverty and her shrouded knightly ancestry. Everything grew more and more extravagant, and she no longer knew how time passed. A sudden jerk shook her in her seat, and Tess awoke from the sleep into which she too had fallen.
They were a long way further on than when S.E. had lost consciousness, and the wagon had stopped. A hollow groan, unlike anything S.E. had ever heard in her life, came from the front, followed by a shout of, "Oi there!" The lantern hanging at her wagon had gone out, but another was shining in her face much brighter than her own had been. Something terrible had happened. The harness was entangled with an object which blocked the way. In consternation, Tess jumped down and discovered the dreadful truth. The groan had proceeded from her father's poor horse Prince. The morning mail cart, with its two noiseless wheels, speeding along these lanes like an arrow, as it always did, had driven into her slow and unlighted equipage. The pointed shaft of the cart had entered the breast of the unhappy prince like a sword, and from the wound his life's blood was spouting in a stream and falling with a hiss into the road. In her despair, Tess sprang forward and put her hand upon the hole, with the only result that she became splashed from face to skirt with the crimson drops. Then she stood helplessly looking on. Prince also stood firm and motionless, as long as he could, till he suddenly sank down in a heap. By this time the mail cart man had joined her, and began dragging and unharnessing the hot form of Prince. But he was already dead, and, seeing that nothing more could be done immediately, the mail cart man returned to his own animal, which was uninjured. "You was on the wrong side," he said. "I'm bound to go on with the mailbags, so that the best thing for you to do is bide here with your load. I'll send somebody to help you as soon as I can. It is getting daylight, and you have nothing to fear." He mounted and sped on his way, while Tess stood and waited. The atmosphere turned pale, the birds shook themselves in the hedges, arose, and twittered. The lane showed all its white features, and Tess showed hers, still whiter. The huge pool of blood in front of her was already assuming the iridescence of coagulation, and when the sun rose, 100 prismatic hues were reflected from it. Prince lay alongside, still and stark, his eyes half open, the hole in his chest looking scarcely large enough to have let out all that had animated him. "'Tis all my doing, all mine," the girl cried, gazing at the spectacle. "Oh, excuse for me none. What will mother and father live on now? Abby, Abby." She shook the child, who had slept soundly through the whole disaster. "He can't go on with our load, Prince is killed." When Abraham realized all, the furrows of 50 years were extemporized on his young face. "Why, I danced and laughed only yesterday," she went on to herself. "Tea to think that I was such a fool. 'Tis because we be on a blighted star, and not a sound one, isn't it, Tess?" murmured Abraham through his tears. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.